I'd like to ask a few questions.
Don would like to ask some questions.
About the history and geography of non-personhood.
Yeah.
Thinking in my own lifetime, in 1952, the U.S. Army was integrated by fiat of President Truman. I experienced that personally as a grammar school child. There were a variety of non-persons independent of the crisis of refugees up against the borders
right.
of the nation state.
Yeah.
So there are, I mean, even polis, everybody who wasn't in the polis was a non-person
yeah.
back in the Greeks, and Arendt and Olson knew that. Now when you go to geography, when Olson goes among the Mayan, he stereotypes native peoples as non-persons. There is very little will in nation politics, Democrat, Republican, or in England, I know Spain very well, to recognize millions and billions of non-persons. So I think you had a very, your poem was great. You had a very trenchant analysis of the issue of immigration into established and relatively prosperous states. But I thought it needed some of this history and geography.
Yeah, I get that. I completely get that. And so the longer project, the book project that this is involved with, is doing that work for sure. Yeah,
I start with Arendt and the Pale of Settlement to get before, you know, even the Nazis, which is a huge movement, condemnation of non-personhood to many living Americans, Jewish ancestors. So the transition from the Pale of Settlement and through this gross hatred and racism of Ezra Pound to the becoming person of Jews. And I think, among other things, that Eleanor Roosevelt was very aware of issues in the Middle East, because she was, in fact, the guiding spirit of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So she may have idealized a certain idea of citizenship based on Enlightenment ideals, but she did have a wide geographical understanding of the work that she was about. I'm sorry, I just wanted to...
No, these are really crucial points, obviously. I'm specifying a concern with a particular form of non-person, which is the form of non-person.
And I get that.
Which
I was the integrity
and
of your
and
own.
I'm being deliberate about that, because the object is not to try and address all the forms of cultural non-personhood that can be produced or documented or are being produced. I'm not trying to do that. Really not. I am explicitly addressing this question of what it means when a person falls into quote-unquote statelessness. And what I'm observing, and I'm hardly the only person to be observing this, is that we are repeatedly told, certainly we are told in the UK, that we are now living through the moment of greatest forced migration since the Second World War, and we are seeing a form of a degree and a level of production of non-personhood that is relatable to that moment, and it's that concern that I'm talking about, and I take Arendt to be very seriously concerned with that in Origins of Totalitarianism and in Human Condition. She wrestled with it in Origins of Totalitarianism, but I think couldn't break from the logics that she was dealing with, and then she has a really strong attempt at it in Human Condition, and I take Olson to be concerned with precisely that sense, that some sense of a space has to be articulated where we might be able to imagine that such non-personhood might obtain. Now, this is not to gainsay, so contemporary Olson is pretty clear in documenting the things that Olson was not good at noticing. Okay, and in the book that I'm writing, I will observe that again. That's a really important thing to say. But then I also want to recover that spatial poetics that Olson presented us with as a resource for thinking through precisely how one might, A, preclude the question of non-personhood arriving, but also, you mentioned geography, of of all writers at that moment, it seems to me Olson is the person who's trying to understand what it means both to be in a place and to be connected to other places, and what it means to make a movement in across those spaces.
I think I would suggest one thing, that the American point of view and the British or the Spanish or the Polish point of view are all different.
Mm.
And you could say European points of view and the American point of view. And one thing I think you could argue for with Olson as an American is a sense of borderless space,
mm.
which sort of is able to assemble its own integrity through processes of perception.
And I would entirely agree with, I couldn't agree more with that. And so, and you know, you know this way better than I do, but the argument in Olson, as Maximus gets going, is with all of those categories, with nation and with state.
Yes.
And it's so, I mean, I'm sitting here in this space, but, and I'm deeply aware of the Americanism of Olson, and I came at Olson through Melville, but I look at him from a different point of view, and he it's that he offers. He's really trying really hard to think that through, which is not to say that either he or Arendt or the Universal Declaration or anyone writing at that moment cracks it, because, you know, we're dealing with that problem right now. But there is a quality of attention being paid to the question of personhood, movement and space at that moment that I feel it's important to recover.
Well, thank you. I just thought a hint of contention might.
Cool, absolutely.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think we have to define space. I grew up in a family that was considered a mixed marriage, and in my day that meant I had a Jewish father and a Christian mother. And my father told stories very rarely, but occasionally told stories of living in the back of a car and living in the south side of Chicago and being stoned on Easter because he was a Jew. His space was an immigrant family from Romania. His space was 2 or 3 square blocks. And that had borders and boundaries as significant as you would need to have a passport.
Yeah.
And if he went outside of that, he was stoned, literally.
Well,
and so I just think the whole concept of space, and we talk about our nations, and we talk about, I worry about microspaces.
Well, I worry about them too. And so in my, in the opening, I've written the first 2 chapters of this text, and the introduction starts with a long account of visiting a house in East London, which is home to 2 people who have sought asylum, and they're in that kind of pending situation that I'm describing, and their relation to space is entirely constricted.
Mm-hmm.
So to give an example of this. They can't work, but they do get a kind of relief. The relief is £5 a day in London, so, and this can go on for, so that's not much. But the relief comes in the form of what's called an Azure card, which can only be spent in designated outlets, can only be spent, this is in the UK in like 2018, can only be spent in designated outlets on designated things, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that isn't designated is public transport.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can't go anywhere. Even when you're not detained, you can't go anywhere. So I am absolutely concerned with the microaggressions that constitute an individual space in this circumstance. And in trying to articulate the kind of spaces that we have made for ourselves, but the kind of spaces also that we might aspire to, it seems to me that Fanon in The Wretched of the Earth, where he's talking precisely about the compartmentalization of space in a colonial environment, he gives us the language for that. And the way I read the British situation is that we learn to practice that elsewhere, and then we have re-imported it, and we're now practicing, now we're inflicting it on in these circumstances. So I completely agree that this paper didn't do that kind of finessing, but I completely agree that we need to be constantly thinking through what are the meanings of space. But the thing that I would say there is that we are, what we're always in this discourse around non-personhood, what we're always running up against is the border itself, not the physical border necessarily of coming into the UK from France, but I don't know, I can't speak to here, but the border is omnipresent in the UK. Everywhere is border, and everybody is border police. As a university academic, then I'm required to take certain registers, and the point of those registers, whether the officials accept it or not, is not to register domestic people, it's to register whether international students are reporting, etc., etc. So our understanding of space is entirely dysfunctional, but it does refer back to the nation as space. So insofar as the kind of the guiding sense of space in this is, it's insofar as there is a guiding sense of space, it's the nation state as space, because it's that nation, it's that is imposing the microaggressions that these people are experiencing.
And I see a connection with Olson there too, because he didn't want Gloucester to be imposed by the rest of America and colonized by the rest of America.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, the word colonization, because I'm amazed we got this far before that word got mentioned. And you said an interesting thing, that these colonial powers practice something, and space here gets really folded. They learn to practice a form of incarceration, of the imposition of small restricted spaces on the outside, and then they bring it on the inside. So what is the relation to all this to colonialism? What is colonialism? I mean, it's odd that it seems to me it's behind it, sort of in a sense behind it. It's interesting that you didn't even mention it, because in a sense, it's maybe you're trying to go beyond the notion.
No, I'm not trying to go. So the whole in reading the conceptualizations of space that one finds in that decade, that 1948 to 1958 period, then precisely what one is addressing is the moment of decolonization, or at least the thing that one is addressing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this is a paper for here, but insofar as what I'm addressing is the period 1948 to 1958, and insofar as what I'm trying to address is the production of a particular kind of non-person, then we are talking about the moment of decolonization. So Arendt is deeply aware of the imperial as a fact in this, and then what the point of Fanon is that he speaks back to that. He gives us an account of the way space is being managed there. What I'm trying to work out is how we talk this space of the non-person that we are compelled to address now is produced by various vectors, obviously, but those vectors were understood in that period, and my sense is that they were understood better in that period because they were emerging in that period. This is the Arendt. It's not that the non-person comes into existence in 1948 or 1950, although I think you could argue that the non-person comes into existence like more or less at the this non-person comes into existence more or less at the turn of the 20th century. That's when certain forms of legislation come to bear. But it's in this moment that there is an actual articulation of what that means, and then there is an articulation of what are the spaces that produce that, and then there is an articulation of how one has to think through space, if one can, in order to prevent it occurring again. And my sense is we need to recover that.
That was great, thanks. And the poem was beautiful. 1948. There's a big elephant in the room.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Palestine.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
And all the laws by which Palestinians became present absentees are British mandate laws.
Yeah.
So it's a very, it's a production of many things at the same time, which does govern us now completely.
I
mean, it's really the essence of it, I think.
I am committed to the view that we're living, that we have to, we simply have to understand ourselves as still living in the post-war period. We have to understand ourselves as living with the problematics that period presented and the conditions that period presented to us. And the role of the British in this, in all of this, is beyond dubious, okay? It's so two factors in this. In 1900, the Americans had legislation which introduced immigration detention slightly before the British, but the British introduced it in 1905. And the British arrived at what they called an enabling fiction. And the enabling fiction said that a person can be understood to have disembarked but not to have landed. And exactly in that, you get all of the logic of the non-person that we are living with now, okay? Come the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there is a debate around the clause, the article, I think it's 13, but it's around asylum. And there is a great movement in the discussion to say that a person has the right to be granted asylum. And the British insert the phrase to enjoy asylum. Mm. And then when they gloss it in the debate, in the discussion, they say, once a person's been granted asylum, we would like them to enjoy it, to all intents and purposes. And so, I mean, it's shameful, but that's precisely the shame. I mean, don't think that our project is not dealing with the shame. We are dealing with the shame. But the British role has been entirely pivotal in that. And it's not as if straightforwardly, if there had been a better wording of that article, then we wouldn't have the issue. But at least we would have a standard by which people could be held to. So yeah, I accept the British rule.
You made a statement.
I have a thought, and it might be off base because unfortunately I haven't read these other philosophical works. I haven't read Olson or the other people, but from listening to what you said, I think maybe I have an advantage that I don't know these other bodies of thought. And so I was just looking at the drivers,
yeah.
And I think one critical driver, well, a bunch of them, that are missing in the form of context is time. Because in totalitarianism, there's a necessity in order to exert control. Isolationism is necessary and lack of communication, because if either of those occurred, the people would uprise. So they have a reason to cut off communications and isolate. Then the second thing is when people have a need, because wars are reoccurring and this always happens, people have a need to have a safety door so that there's some sort of global community that theoretically is supposed to exist right now, of asylum. However, there is also a need to reduce danger by knowledge. And the reduction of the increase of the knowledge base, what is important there is time. If it could happen like that, you wouldn't have the problem. So I think that if you address the problem from a totally different direction, which is how does the non-totalitarian world reduce time to reduce risks? You know, the time of knowledge is smaller. And so therefore, there has to be a universal database. We would all hate it, but there has to be a universal database of the free world, so that you almost have an international passport under asylum, but they know who you are.
So the time thing, I mean, it would be a madness on my part to think that temporality wasn't a consideration here. And it's obviously a consideration, because well, the driver here is this question of detention and indefinite detention, and temporality is the form of abuse there. That it's temporality that is being abused. So that's absolutely for sure. What I'm trying to observe about the discourse at the what I'm trying to observe about the way the Universal Declaration has been received and reduced, and I think sort of misrecognized, is that it's typically been regarded in terms of the way an individual person progresses through the temporality of their life. So that's what those writers I was talking about, referring to right at the beginning, they think about human personality and the growth of personality and what it means for a person to become a full human, etc. And that's, you know, that's a part of the discourse of human, of the human rights, of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But I tend to think that the more powerful contribution that document makes, which we're able to see if we set it alongside some of these other documents, is that there is a what it's trying to articulate is the relations that people have to one another, their basic relationality, and therefore what it's concerned with is space. I mean, it's Arendt's argument at the end of Origins of Totalitarianism. Finally, having kind of documented the whole history, she arrives at the view that really what totalitarianism does is collapse space between people. It just kind of it pushes people together. It so totalizes that all sense of spatiality is lost. Well, you can believe that or not. What I'm interested in is the fact that non-personhood is produced in particular kinds of spaces and by a particular kind of politics of space, and that's a thing that we ought to be addressing. Not that we shouldn't also be addressing other things.
Spaces cannot be maintained without a lack of community. It's
for
a combination
of
communication and fear.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, because knowledge is transmitted through communication.
Yeah.
And division is created through fear.
Yeah.
And totalitarian dictators always use fear in order to exert control and reduce the ability to have communication. So
yeah.
I think those are the drivers that need to be.
I guess what I see in the situation in the UK is, so there is an abuse of temporality, but the more compelling abuse is the abuse of the individual's capacity simply to move around. It goes back to this question here, the micromanagement and the microaggression against individual and individual movement. So that's what in a UK context for sure is being most manipulated.
But like the neighborhood kind of thing.
Yeah.
What creates those micro cosms?
Yeah.
Is really fear.
Oh, for sure, fear.
And lack of understanding.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. For sure, fear.
Are you gonna call on me?
I'm not sure that's really my job. I was just, no, Don couldn't see behind
no,
him, so
no,
I wanted to
no.
make sure.
All right, I just really, really briefly, the line of poetry that keeps recurring to me as a kind of hopeful line is from a Leonard Cohen song called Anthem, and he says, every heart to love will come, but like a refugee, which, I don't know, I find...
Can you say it again?
Nice.
Can you say it again?
Every heart to love will come, but like a refugee. It's just something to contemplate that's hopeful. I don't have any analysis. It's just
there's a huge amount in
that.
So
it's just in my heart.
And a thing that I'm interested to think about is how much better people are, not all people, but many people are, than states. And what it means to everybody sees this all of the time in their activities. And what it might mean to think about that in terms of scale. So there's no shortage of locations where exactly that sentiment is being articulated and expressed. But there is then this larger question of what you do with a political geography that is imposing itself on those. And that's a thing that needs thinking through, it seems to me.
It's just a
yeah.
It's just a heart song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It reminds me of another poem, a line by Langston Hughes. I too am an American.
Sing America. I too sing America.
Well, that too, right.
Yeah.
The whole thing. You're dealing with Brexit, I guess, but I happen to believe that it's not the unanimous position in the UK. And I was really wondering when you didn't acknowledge the dream of Europe. I mean, where 95 or 98% of the people do have, you know, the privilege of universal citizenship. Sure, there are many immigrant issues too that need to be worked out, but not yet as maybe the Hungary and Poland, but not yet as severely as England. I mean, one has to acknowledge that the dream of borderless communication through various regions and nationalities and natalities is still real. I'd like to hear that note sometime.
Yeah, but even that has a very strict border. I mean, the Europe has a huge, I mean.
Well, it depends. I mean, I have no problem flying in and out of Europe. Probably you had no problem flying in and out of the United States.
You guys are both white men, though.
Yes.
there's that, too.
Well, it's
exactly.
Worse being a man, though, right now, too.
Well,
in that regard.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say something about Fanon and connect something to what you were saying about the need for knowledge and understanding, because it's interesting that you were mainly talking about his influence as a psychiatrist and his understanding of needing a new mentality and how people were crushed by colonialism.
Yeah.
The great thing is that in so many countries they rose up.
For sure.
And
yeah.
And that at least we have Mandela as president of South Africa as a result of people sitting around reading Fanon and realizing what was going on from reading Fanon. Having knowledge of that, you know, they needed to get rid of the mentality of the dictator,
the brainwashing,
and have some new way of conceiving of themselves and their country, and those countries have borders, and they needed it. He saw that as a step. Right?
Yes, he did. Absolutely, you're right.
Right.
You're completely right about that. Obviously, yeah,
just,
yeah.
Fanon
yeah.
seems like a crucial element here, and so. This whole business of colonialism, I think colonialism, I mean, it stands to reason that you didn't discuss it because part of your argument was left out. But just to go back to what Don was saying, he sort of took you to task for, you know, the Maya and the those who were excluded from polis. These notions of barbarian or Gentile go way back. So empire seems like critical, the whole notion of empire. Seems like a critical component in, and like I say, if you're discussing Fanon, I could see why Fanon would be crucial to what you've already said.
Yeah, I can only confirm that it is.
right.
So, and so insofar as what this book is trying to do, but also what Arendt was trying to do, what Arendt is trying to articulate the various settings and forces which produce this sense of the non-person. And her sense is that we have certainly lived with all kinds of prejudice and alienation and cultural neglect, and we have et cetera, et cetera. But this particular sense of the legal non-person is a relatively recent invention, and that that one of the settings in which this occurs is precisely in the colonial setting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
decolonization.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's
yeah,
crucial.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
not,
absolutely.
I mean, the whole argument is not
right. Here. No, decolonization really is the context you're talking about, 48 to
yeah.
58.
Just to come back to Brexit.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me started on Brexit, but you're absolutely, it's, I mean, this, my project is about what it's about, okay?
Yeah.
And what it, and the phenomenon it's describing predated Brexit by some time, okay. But yes, absolutely. But unfortunately, that Brexit confirms a sensibility in the UK that we can see echoed in these other situations, and it will make these phenomena worse, almost certainly. And you're absolutely right that for all the problems with Europe, and we see them on a daily basis with the crossings across the Mediterranean, obviously, there was at least articulated there a principle of free movement. And it's a catastrophe for the UK that precisely what we've seceded from is the principle of free movement. It's a, you know.
I've found refugees in Malaga, so, but there's no answer. The stream is truly endless. But it's not that huge an impact. I mean, even Germany has absorbed what it has absorbed. It's its right-wing factions that are up in arms. It's just like in the United States. People don't like blacks to get positions in the fire department because the family is up in arms. I was going to say something else on Fanon. You know, one of his most famous statements in Blackface is whatever has to do with what the colonial subject learned was how to rape, pillage, govern, take bribes, and all that other kind of stuff. And that was so notoriously received that I believed it was actually implicated in his failure to achieve medical care that he needed from the Algerian France that led to his demise in Canada. So, I mean, everybody's got their own case and nobody is singing the absolute universal message that we all have to hear. I think Arendt is probably closest.
And and so it seems to me an argument for a very least a cross-disciplinary approach to this kind of concern.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So the argument is not, my argument is not that in any of these texts we find the articulation that we need, but what we do find as we push these texts together that we're thinking about these same concerns is the possibility of arriving at insights and forms of articulation, you know, in between and overlapping and across. So
that's why I'm, you know, for these interchange zones, correct, as opposed to borders when I advance theories.
When you do advanced negotiations, the only way that you actually get a deal is if you figure out how to get to win-win.
Yeah.
So if you look at the juxtaposition between the edges of assimilation and segregate, I don't know whether segregation is the right word, but I don't mean by color. Segregation. If you look at the juxtaposition between those, the juxtaposition between knowledge and fear, and the juxtaposition between imposed leadership versus leading with free will.
Yeah.
That, I think, outlines how you have to find the win-win between them. They both have equal, to a certain extent, they both have equal rights to their side of the juxtaposition.
So in our, I don't know if I'm interpreting it correctly, but in our project, the Refugee Tales Project, we walk, we tell the stories. The stories are about detention. They're powerful stories. And then the stories have been published, and then what we do is we take the stories to politicians and we say, here are the consequences of your policy.
Of the improper system.
And what we are trying to do, for good or ill, is we are trying to identify the levers that might make a more open space possible. And so we're identifying detention, clearly, as a thing that it would be possible from a straightforward moral standpoint to end. We could, indefinite detention, you can make an argument to a politician, even a politician who signed up for it, you can make the argument that indefinite detention ought to end. And you can gain purchase there, and that's a thing that can be won. And then we are also arguing that we also believe that you can, in the UK, you can win the argument to the right to work. Because there's all kinds of ways in which that's a question that can be successfully argued over. So I don't know if this is like, I don't know if we're
but
arriving at a win.
Is fear.
Well,
the barrier is fear because there is a real
there,
fear.
I mean, we can't, we're, in a way, we're not, we are in our project anyway, we are not looking to address the whole
the
machinery.
Just
we say, what we're identifying is those aspects of policy and practice that prevent a person having access to space in the way that a person whose citizenship is not queried has access to space. And I have the view that work is crucial to this and a proper understanding of what it means to participate in the making of a culture. The first thing that occurs when a society wants to problematize an individual is they problematize their relation to work. It's a thematic, and so we're working away at that.
I think on that note, I'd like to close this because the Gloucester Writers Center is a working writers center in a working town, and we've had a lot of work here this evening, and I think we should stop and push the chairs aside, and this conversation can take place in a less formal situation. David, thank you very much.